the mission. We run the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want. We want. We want. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, U.S. petrodollar hegemony and global imperialism. We're joined by Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar about the price of oil and the real threat of war being pushed by U.S. brinksmanship. Later in the program, we'll be joined by journalist Mike Whitney of Counterpunch regarding the connection between Ukraine and sudden drop in global oil prices. Eric Dreitzer of Stop Imperialism will also join the program. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we'll be looking at international relations, the threat of war being pushed by U.S. brinksmanship. We'll also be talking about connections between the Ukraine and sudden drop in global oil prices with our several guests. And here is Peter to introduce our first guest today.
Pepe Escobar is a Brazilian journalist. He writes a column called The Roving Eye for Asia Times Online and works as an analyst for Russia Today and Tom Engelhardt's TomsDispatch.com. He's also written for The Nation, Al Jazeera, and Real News. A long history of focusing on Central Asia and the Middle East. He's also done extensive work in Afghanistan, interviewed Taliban members going back for two decades now. He's worked with Russia Today Television and Press TV at Al Jazeera. Pepe, welcome to our show.
Wonderful to be back, and it's always good to talk to you guys.
We're putting a show together that really focuses on the collapse of the oil prices and who's behind that and why that's happening. That's partly tied into what's going on in Ukraine and putting pressure on Russia. And you wrote a piece called, Will Russia and Germany Save Europe from War? Tell us about that and your thinking along these lines.
In fact, that was a modest proposal come provocation. I love provocation. And I was already fed up discussing with some of my sources, analysts, businessmen, captains of industry, and everybody's fed up with this war hysteria. Is it Cold War 2.0? Has the Cold War never left? Whatever that is, this is not the narrative that the world wants to hear, in fact. This is about, I would say, a few Washington Wall Street elites and a very, very tiny elite in Europe itself, partly in London, and certainly not in Germany, in the Eastern European countries, of course, and especially Poland and the Baltic states. I cannot reveal the number one source for this modest proposal. You would be amazed, but I have to protect my source. I can only tell you that it's an American. And then I decided to publish two. Let's stimulate the debate. And it got a lot of traction in Russia. A lot of people in Germany are discussing it, and even some of my American friends are discussing it as well. It is, of course, totally far-fetched. It's a partition of Ukraine. It's not going to happen. But it's even more plausible than this narrative of a new nuclear war with Europe as the theater, and it will be a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. This is completely crazy. And the Russian leadership, they are taking this very, very seriously. They know that if the neocons get their way in the U.S. in the next few years, this could become a real possibility on the table again. Some of them are talking about the post-MED environment, mutually assured destruction. It's very, very possible for the next few years. So I was trying to diffuse all this and come up with a little bit of swing, a little bit of sense of humor. Okay, why don't we partition Ukraine? Everybody gets a share, and we stop with this nonsense.
Well, you write about how the Russian ICBMs are the state of the art. Their Mach 7 400-kilometer missile, they're not someone to be pushed around.
This is really serious, Peter. All these numbers and this data about Russian nuclear and ballistic capabilities, they are 100% trustworthy, and they're really serious. And I didn't even talk about the S-500 system, which is going to be rolled out in maybe 2017. Even the S-400s and the Iskanders, they can wreak havoc all over, anywhere they want, in fact. And not to mention the, you know, the Chinese, they are building submarines that they can go virtually undetected everywhere, including around the U.S. So if we want to be alarmist, or instead of realist, the possibility of a really hardcore confrontation is over there, because Russia and China, they are weaponizing themselves very, very fast. But nobody wants this, of course. But we still keep hearing, especially from NATO, these absolutely crazy generals and politicians, especially Eastern Europeans, all the time, that Russian aggression and NATO has to counter it. Russia is going to invade or has already invaded Europe virtually every day. It's completely ridiculous. But in terms of weaponizing, Russia and China are taking it very, very seriously.
Pepe Escobar, you write in your recent article, Will Russia, Germany Save Europe from War? Listeners can go to Asia Times to find that article by Pepe Escobar. You write about a wall, a new Berlin Wall that's happening in Ukraine. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. One of the key unstated objectives in the American hidden agenda of advancing NATO to the Russian western borderlands, it's to isolate Russia. Of course, we read in U.S. corporate media all sorts of apparatchiks in the Beltway talking about isolating Russia. What they actually mean is Russia behind this new Berlin Wall, which runs through Kiev, skirts around Ukraine, and it's basically from the Baltic countries in the north to the Black Sea in the south. And keep Russia away from all this, meaning essentially keeping Russia away from doing business with Europe. Energy business, trade and investments, and especially German-Russia commercial relationship, which is very, very strong. So obviously, and what happened this week, it's a fantastic counterpunch, as I would put it. The whole South Stream pipeline controversy, in fact. The European Commission, under pressure from the Americans, and including the famous visits by U.S. senators to countries in Southeast Europe, such as Bulgaria, to pressure them not to accept the South Stream pipeline. In the end, the Russians, they looked at the configuration of the whole situation, and they said, okay, we don't care about this anymore. You don't want our pipeline. You don't want our gas. It's your problem. We're going to build a gas pipeline anyway, but instead of going to Southeast Europe, to you, that you need it, it's going to Turkey. So if you want to do business with us, you have to go through Turkey in 3-4 years' time. It was an amazing counterpunch, and you should see the reaction in Brussels and in Europe these past 2 days. They are like headless chickens. They never saw it coming, and they provoked it. They provoked it. And even the governments in Hungary and Bulgaria, they were in favor of South Stream because they would make a lot of money out of it in terms of transit fees as well. Not only will get gas that they need, but they'll have transit fees. Now the whole thing is scrapped, at least for the moment. The European Commission, now they have to explain themselves to 3 or 4 Southeast European countries. They don't have a plan B. A plan B will be gas from Iran, but this could take years. A plan C would be gas from Turkmenistan. It could also take years. A plan D would be gas from Qatar if they build a pipeline through Syria. This could also take years. That's it. They shot themselves in their in their heads once again.
Pepe, it seems that the U.S. is pushing a strong stance against Russia in the ultimate hopes, of course, getting Ukraine to go NATO. But at the same time, Germany is doing business with Russia in a very big way and very dependent upon their natural gas for heating and industrial uses. So that is a complication. And you had written an article earlier, too, about the increased use of German and Russian business and also how that reaches all the way into China with a planned super train going all the way from China to Central Europe. Some really positive economic transformation. And I'm getting the impression from your writing that the U.S. is kind of trying to undermine this.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And the way I see it, this is the big trade commerce story for the next 10 years. From now to 2025, when the Chinese are planning to finish what they called the Silk Road Economic Belt, New Silk Road. In fact, it's subdivided. There are so many Silk Roads. There are at least three major Silk Roads, two of them overland, one of them via the Trans-Siberian, which is going to become a high-speed rail Trans-Siberian in a few years, another one through Central Asia, Iran, Turkey, and another one, a maritime Silk Road through the Indian Ocean. They all converge where? In Europe, in Venice, and especially in Germany. So the president of China, Xi Jinping, he went to Germany last year in May, and he sold the idea directly to German business. And obviously the Germans said, wow, this is exactly what we want. We want to do fast commerce, trade, business, with Eurasia as a whole. Eurasia as a whole means essentially the two big Eurasian powers, Russia and China. And if you can do it via high-speed rail, which cut costs, and it's much faster than doing it by container trade, plying the oceans, in fact, this in 10 years, this will revolutionize, I would say, the whole way Eurasia does business. You know, most of the world, 60-70% of the world does business. And this involves Russia and China together, because one of the branches of the Silk Road is the Trans-Siberian. So everything will pass from Beijing to Moscow, from Moscow to Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And then the Maritime Silk Road involves ports in Iran, for instance. Iran is part of it as well. Turkey is a very important player because the Silk Road goes through Turkey, and Istanbul is a key crossroads. So what we're talking about here in the long run is trade commerce integration of all these countries, from Southeast Europe to the Middle East, Southwest Asia, Central Asia, and East Asia. And when the U.S. looks at the way this is being developed, especially by the Chinese, because there's already a $40 billion U.S. dollar fund to start building a lot of stuff, you know, and the pipelines, which involve especially Russia spreading their pipelines all over the place, future pipelines from Central Asia as well, and fiber optics, you name it. So in 10 years, when we look at this whole region, we're going to see a very, very modern integration among all these countries. And the U.S. will be an outsider, really. A virtually complete outsider, even having privileged relationships with some of these countries. But I'll give you an example. In terms of Japan and South Korea, even if they have very close to the U.S., in terms of energy, their future is Russia. And Russia is going to clinch very, very important deals to sell more oil and gas to Asia as a whole, not only China, but Japan and South Korea as well, and to India. Putin is going to India next week. You know what they're going to do? Business, more deals, more energy, you know. So you can imagine how paralyzed are the elites in the U.S. when they look at the state of things. So I understand their paranoia and their aggressiveness based on the fact that the unipolar moment is dying little by little every day.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar. We'll be back after this musical break. We're speaking with Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar. He is the author of Globalization, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War, among other books. Most recently, Pepe Escobar's newest book just out is called Empire of Chaos. You can follow him on Facebook. You can also read his work at Asia Times. Pepe Escobar, when you were just speaking about Japan and Russia and some of the economic issues going on in that part of the world, could you comment a little bit on what's behind the U.S. push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which obviously leaves aside Russia and China?
Exactly. I can tell you, you know, straight away that I would say 80% of all the push behind the TPP died at the latest APEC summit in Beijing. Because all the countries at the APEC, they approved a preliminary study. It's going to take a while. It's going to take probably 2 years for a real Asian-based and Asian-controlled trade agreement, which is completely different from TTP. How can you have a major regional trade agreement, including the U.S., that bypasses China? This is completely stupid because China is the number one trading partner of all these countries. I'm talking about especially the 10 members of the ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations. China is the number one partner of all of them. They are the number one trade partner of Bangladesh, South Asia as well. So it makes no sense. Probably what we're going to have in the next few years, the next 2 or 3 years, is the approval of this China-instigated, let's put it this way, trade deal. TPP will be scrapped because very important countries in Asia don't want TPP because they see it for what it is. It's an economic NATO made in U.S. deal, dealt in secret, elaborated in secret, redacted in secret by corporations, basically, with no public opinion participation whatsoever. And Malaysia and Japan, for instance, they're very much against it because they see it as American corporations taking over the Malaysian and the Japanese market. In Japan, especially the automotive industry and agriculture. So I don't see a TPP going absolutely anywhere. And I followed what happened in APEC very closely in Beijing. And the other arm of the whole thing is the trade deal with the Europeans, which the Americans are doing everything they can to impose on the European Commission, the European Union in Brussels. That's a more complicated story because many countries, in fact, going for it. But there is still a lot of, I would say, opposition among some of them, especially France, Italy, agricultural interests in Europe. And if you speak to the average European, this is something I've been doing this year, for instance, in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, they'll say, oh, the Americans are going to come here and invade us with the GMOs, with chemicals, with toxic stuff. They take over our agriculture and with our small, specialized, quality, organic agriculture. So this is the opinion of 80%, 90% of the average European. But the battle for the trade deal in Europe, from an American point of view, it's much more advanced. In Asia, I would say it's already lost.
Pepe, what you're telling us a very important story here, and that is how Central Asia and Europe are increasing trade. They're the core geographical centers of the world in terms of numbers of people and countries and capital expansion and growth. And you're really describing a story here. China also has been very involved in trade with Brazil and other countries in South America. Has been seen as a threat by the American neocons for 15 years. And in one sense, there seems to be this, well, we're going to build a bigger army and have better weapons, and we're going to control China and Russia. On the other hand, you're saying that that's just impossible, and that the Chinese submarines play a game by surfacing next to U.S. aircraft carriers, and the U.S. didn't even know they were there.
Exactly. But look, this is it's typical imperial delusion of people who live in a bubble. We all know how decision makers or policy makers in the Beltway, they live in a bubble. Everybody knows that, you know. In fact, many Americans suspect it. But a lot of people in Europe or in Asia who follow American foreign policy closely, they know how the Beltway works. And, you know, they don't speak other languages. They don't travel. They don't see what's happening around the world. And it's always an American-centric view of the world. American-centric, I'm not talking about America as a country and people. I'm talking in terms of foreign policy. I grew up with the U.S. and admiring so many aspects of the U.S. And what the Chinese and the Russians and the Germans in the future, and I foresee in the long run, especially point of view of the German business and industry classes. They want a trade commercial partnership and alliance with Russia because they want to profit from this new Eurasian integration. And Turkey will be part of it. Iran will be part of it. India will be part of it. So we're talking about the big developing countries, and we're talking essentially about the three of the BRICS involved, Russia, China, and India, and Brazil in terms of that flight away from the dollar and the petrodollar as well in the future. That's one of the main worries in the Beltway. They hate the BRICS in Washington because the BRICS are proposing a different realignment of international relations in terms of starting with having more voice inside the IMF. Okay, you're not going to give us. Okay, we have our own development bank, which they already started a few months ago. It will be operating starting 2015-2016. They are trading, they are doing currency swaps. They're trading their own currencies. This means yuan, ruble, yuan, real, etc. They are, some of them are very complementary to others, like Brazil and China or Russia and China. They have a very strong voice in, say, the G20. They are, I would say, followed with admiration by a lot of the developing world. That's the non-aligned movement, NAM, 120 nations. So when you put it all together, and the fact that they are basically, okay, we want a rearrangement of the system because we want an international relations system that is more fair to developing nations, essentially, and not controlled ruthlessly and unilaterally by the U.S., just like they still control Europe. And obviously, a lot of people in Europe, they look at this and say, well, we would like to be part of it as well. But the fact is, Europe, in many aspects, is still occupied territory by the Americans. And if you talk to informed Europeans in Europe, they're going to tell you that. And they know it. But they say, no, it's Pina. There is no alternative. What are you going to do? We're going to be submitted by the Chinese? No, it's different. If you do partnerships, commercial partnerships with these countries in Eurasia, that's the future. And even in terms of bringing more jobs to Europe.
Pepe Escobar, we only have a couple minutes left in this segment, but we wanted to ask one more question, given how much you've written about the subject, including U.S.-Russian relations. There's obviously a propaganda war afoot here. You wrote a little bit about that in your Washington Plays Russian Roulette article at Asia Times. Peter and I have written about it as well. But in this propaganda war of this demonization of Putin, and again, this isn't to suggest that Putin is some savior, it's a black and white issue. I know that you have been targeted by many critics who claim that you're pro-Putin, and again, they try to turn it into something that it isn't, and turn some things that you may be saying that you were not. And I just wanted to give you the last couple minutes here to maybe clarify or talk a little bit about that, and how, well, even you have been sort of used as a pawn in some of this propaganda war.
This is ridiculous. Look, I've been a foreign correspondent for 30 years working all over the world. I have been called, just to give an idea, a commie, a Maoist, an Al-Qaeda mole, a Taliban infiltrator, a CIA agent, all of the above.
That's quite a resume, Pepe.
Exactly. So it's ridiculous. When we discuss issues and policies, that's another story. This is what I do in my professional career. The fact that I did the good aspects of what Russia and China are doing in terms of their trade, commerce, political, economic advances, and the BRICS as well, doesn't mean that I endorse them. Same thing with Brazil. I was born in Brazil, but I don't endorse neither the previous administrations, which were center-right neoliberal, nor the Workers' Party. Not at all. In fact, at the last election, I annulled my vote. But it's very different to follow the good things that they are doing everywhere. In terms of Russia, I am a frequent guest of Russian media. I write for some of them. They are always asking my opinion about a lot of stuff. It doesn't mean that I'm working for the Kremlin.
Exactly.
People simply cannot see that. It's so obvious to me. But for a lot of people, it's not. So we could say the same thing for people who work for CNN. Okay, you work for the State Department, the CIA. You know, it's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. I don't even bother to answer.
We agree on that count, Pepe Escobar, that we should be focusing on the issues and the facts and not attacking or shooting the messengers.
So, exactly. Yeah. It's shooting the... In fact, on my Facebook page and via people who have my public email, the email that is published in most of the articles, I'm getting this stuff all the time, you know. So I don't even bother to answer. When people give me good stuff, facts, and they start a constructive dialogue, that's a completely different story. And a lot of people in the U.S., they can see where I'm coming from. They have already identified that I'm trying to go after the real stories behind everything that is happening. It's not a matter of ideology. China, for instance, it's a very fine line. There are a lot of stuff that we know that don't work inside the structure of the Chinese Communist Party. I prefer to focus on the positive because they are trying to change something and they are trying to change the world, in fact. This is a huge story. I have been following China closely since I moved to Asia 20 years ago. So it's a day-to-day job to see this aircraft carrier that is China moving around. It's fascinating. And of course, we know about all their problems. We know about autocratic tendencies inside Russia, obviously. We know about the pyramid scheme that runs China, obviously. But I prefer to focus on what they're trying to change that and what they're trying to do to change the configuration not only of Eurasia, but the rest of the way the world does business. I think it's a much more important story.
Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for offering your perspective today on these key issues. We're very delighted to have you on the Project Censored show because, as you were saying, a lot of the things that you are focusing on are absent from a lot of the discourse and the dialogue about global relations. So Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar, you can read his recent work at Asia Times, atimes.com. Your recent article, Will Russia, Germany Save Europe from War? Pepe Escobar, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks very much. A pleasure to be with you guys, and I hope this was helpful. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
We've been talking to Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar. After this musical break, we'll be joined by Mike Whitney and Eric Dreitzer. Please stay with us.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We continue our discussion today about the U.S. brinkmanship around the globe. We're going to be looking a little more carefully now at connections between the Ukraine, Syria, sudden drop in global oil prices, many, many things that are happening. And the perspectives we're offering on the Project Censored show here are perspectives that you clearly do not hear, certainly not in the U.S. corporate press, but even in some of the so-called alternative media. One of our guests here for the remainder of the program is Eric Dreitzer. He's an independent political analyst and the founder of StopImperialism.org. His work focuses primarily on geopolitics and the role of imperialism in the modern world. Dreitzer's articles have appeared in many publications, both in the U.S. and internationally, and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. He's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Russia Today, Press TV, Global Research, and a variety of other media outlets. He joins us today from New York City. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Also on the line with us is Mike Whitney. He's a freelance writer. He lives in Washington State. He writes regularly for Counterpunch. Mike won the Project Censored Award back in 2006 for an investigative piece on Operation Falcon, a massive stealth dragnet that orchestrated by the Bush administration and has expanded itself quite rapidly throughout the country. And we bring particular attention to a piece that Mike wrote that was published on Information Clearinghouse, is where we saw it, but I think it came from Counterpunch. And it was entitled Ukraine War, Driven by Gas Dollar Link, Defending Dollar Imperialism. And we've seen a sudden drop in gas prices, or oil prices worldwide, a significant drop. And you say there's more to that. Mike, can you tell us a little bit about that?
I know this is discredited as a conspiracy theory, but I think if people look a little more closely at it, they'll see that the United States has actually pulled off the gloves when it comes to their response to Russia. And the reason that is true is not just because of the Ukraine dust-up, but because Russia is threatening U.S. vital interests by saying that they're threatening to go off the dollar, by building up their gold reserves, by building alliances in the BRICS and a banking system that or a banking institution that is going to compete with the IMF. Basically, they are creating an alternate system, which the United States, Washington takes rather seriously, and that's, you know, what's going on. The big picture here is that, you know, just to elaborate for a second, is the United States actually wants to keep things the way that they are right now, and Russia poses a grave threat to that by its economic integration with Europe, which doesn't benefit the United States at all. And that's what Ukraine is about. They're trying to sever that link between Russia selling gas into the European market. But as far as the link between the dollar and gas is the fact that John Kerry, earlier in the year, went to Saudi Arabia and worked out a deal with King Abdullah that they would flood the market, because flooding the market with oil would push the prices down. And since Russia depends on, I think, 60% of its economy is built on oil exports, that was going to have a dramatic effect on weakening them. And, you know, as their economy weakens, their resolve to fight the United States or their ability to respond is going to weaken correspondingly. So I think that's basically what we're looking at.
Eric Dreitzer, do you want to come in here and chime in about what Mike Whitney was just talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I certainly would agree with it. I would just add a slight caveat. First of all, on the one hand, it is true that the United States and the West generally is looking to maintain status quo. But on the other hand, we should remember that status quo is really an expansionary policy. For 25 years, you've seen an eastward expansion of NATO, which has been driven primarily by the United States at the initiative of the United States, incorporating former Soviet bloc countries, the Baltic states, and of course later Poland and then Georgia, and certainly Ukraine should be understood as at least in part an attempt to pry Ukraine out of the Russian orbit and pull it into NATO's orbit. So in that regard, status quo is really a continuing expansion eastward of NATO, and that's precisely, I think, at the root of much of this conflict. And I think what Mike is saying is absolutely true with regard to the gambit that the United States is playing using Saudi Arabia for the purposes of flooding the market. I think that there are some consequences to that I think are going to be quite interesting to follow. First of all, the attack on the Russian economy is driving down the ruble, and in many ways this can be seen as a destabilizing element. But on the other hand, it seems that this is precisely the spark that is meant to drive domestic production in Russia, that it will make Russian manufactured goods and Russian goods generally more enticing to international customers. So I think that there is a backfire, a boomerang effect here in what the United States is doing vis-a-vis the sanctions and the isolation of Russia's economy, that it'll come back on them. And I think that really kind of dovetails with a lot of the other policies that we're seeing. I mean, we have news regarding the U.S. Congress passing anti-Russian legislation. We know that there's legislation that's been introduced, such as the Russian Aggression Prevention Act, S-2277. So they're trying to legislate while also using military and other forms of power this essentially state of conflict and state of war with Russia, which is, of course, driving some of Russia's moves vis-a-vis China and some of its other partners.
Well, let's go back to Mike here and ask this question. We certainly know that oil is down to about $70 a barrel from $100 a barrel less than 5 months ago, and the Russian Central Bank is saying it may even go down to $60. That impacts the Russians in particular. It also impacts other countries that aren't on our like list, like Iran and Venezuela. So that there seems to be something to be said that there's a U.S. pushing this to get the Saudis to expand their production and bring up oil prices down. in addition to that, it has undermined the dollar and the ruble relationship. The ruble's at the lowest level since 1998 to the dollar, which may encourage in the long run more trade, but it certainly weakens them initially. Mike, what's motivating all of this, besides just trying to get NATO to occupy the Ukraine?
Well, it's really a drastic move, and basically the United States is expressing how important this conflict with Russia to them is. And essentially, you have to understand what the overview from Washington's perspective is that their game in this next century is called the pivot to Asia. And so they are reorienting themselves away from the Middle East to what they feel is going to be the profit center, the growth center, and the most prosperous area of the world. And part of that plan involves tightening the encirclement of Russia and breaking it up, possibly, if they can, and installing U.S. stooges there, if possible, and then containing, which is to say, keeping China as weak and divided as possible so they can control the explosive growth of the Chinese economy. That's the game plan. Now, I know in the big picture, people are hearing this thinking that this is insane, but this is the gambit. This is what they're trying to do. So you have to analyze things in terms of that bigger picture, and then you can understand that the reason the United States is in Ukraine and supporting this, wacko Nazi-backed regime is because they think this is all feasible, because they think, as Eric said, that they can expand NATO to a couple hundred miles to Moscow and to keep expanding their military bases throughout, and that they can maintain their dominance, their dollar hegemony, by keeping the flow of natural gas and oil denominated in dollars. That's the secret. When these things are no longer, when the energy is no longer denominated in dollars, then what is the incentive for all the countries around the world whose economies have stockpiled dollars and bought U.S. bonds, et cetera, to maintain that flow of currency?
And Mike Whitney, you're connecting this to the sacking of Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, this strategy in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Ukraine.
Yes. Chuck Hagel was no peacenik, but let's admit it. I mean, compared to Samantha Powers and Susan Rice and Victoria Nuland, I mean, he was like Timothy Leary or something. It's just ridiculous. So, now, and this just shows the obtuseness of the Obama administration. Yes, they have this spokesman who seems eminently reasonable and eloquent and erudite and all that kind of stuff in Obama, but the people who are making the decision-making are just absolutely bananas, These people are just warmongering fanatics, and I'm not sure you would want to trust your nuclear arsenal to someone who is as impetuous as someone like Susan Rice, but that's the situation we find ourselves in.
It's very dangerous, and earlier in the show, Pepe was laying out the capabilities of the nuclear weapons and both the Chinese and Russia have, and it's not something that's easily going to fall away. And there's a cost here, Mike, I'd like you to mention a little bit, respond to. There's a cost to the U.S. as well, because certainly as oil prices go down, the shale oil production, which is very large in the U.S., becomes more expensive than what the oil is worth. So,
there's costs that are larger than that, and that's the risk involved in the markets, okay? Because probably as Eric can tell you that, 30% of the high yield debt, which is all this people have been pushing this money into this these junk bonds, is in the energy funds. And if people go rushing for the exits all of a sudden, that could cause another, trigger another financial crisis. But yeah, as you point out, there are unintended consequences. The United States, Washington doesn't want to crush these new industries like the shale industry. They're invested heavily in those things. But, this is a question of priorities. The guys like Brzezinski, this is the last train out. They're hoping to accomplish their dream, their New World Order type alignment. While it's still possible. And they don't see it as being beneficial to them at all to allow Russia to maintain, their connection with the European market, get stronger and stronger, build stronger and stronger, military assets. How is that in their benefit? They have to make this transition now if they're going to maintain the hegemony that they're so used to. And you know what? these guys love that, and they're not going to give it up easily.
And we see, of course, Hillary Clinton. That's their hawkish hope for 2016. She's been palling around with Brzezinski in the last few months. And again, these people are behind the scenes. We, you know, last week we interviewed Peter Dale Scott and talked about an American deep state and so forth. You know, there are people behind the scenes here that are calling the shots, that are vetting the people that the public, you know, gets to lend their vote to at some point. And one can only imagine that the candidates are going to need to be vetted such that they support this kind of policy, the empire strategy against Russia, isolating Russia, and so forth.
But you remember, Hagel was a Brzezinski pick. So the fact that they're replacing him with Ashton Carter suggests that the neocons are back in power.
Yeah, well, it's almost difficult to tell the difference between some of these people in terms of the global power grab. I mean, other than the, you know, of course, the arguments between hard, soft power. But I think you're right about the hard power approach.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with journalist Mike Whitney and Eric Dreitzer of Stop Imperialism. We'll be right back after this musical break.
Listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are now speaking with journalist Mike Whitney, and we're also speaking with Eric Dreitzer of StopImperialism.org. And Eric Dreitzer, let's bring you back into the conversation to comment about some of this soft, hard power dynamic and the strategy against Russia.
Soft power really should be understood as a means by which the United States and the West in general projects their power into these theaters of conflict where they're really not able to engage in direct military action. So military power being hard power, soft power really kind of being this abstract concept of everything else. And I think when we think about soft power, we need to think about the ways in which it is used in order to pursue a very specific and very clear agenda. I think we should be clear that soft power includes everything from complete control and dissemination of information in the media, but it also means control on the streets, being able to manufacture so-called social movements and being able to manipulate those social movements towards certain ends. I think in the context of what we've been talking about here, the Maidan movement would be a good example. We can think back to other examples of color revolutions in Iran and in Georgia and in Ukraine in 2004 as well. And all of these have a lot of these similarities. They are all deeply, how should we say, orchestrated and or facilitated by these so-called civil society organizations. And all of these civil society organizations, or many of them, are linked back to the United States, to the U.S. government through various means, whether we're talking about money being given by the National Endowment for Democracy or the so-called NGOs of the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, and many, many others. They are all deeply penetrated in places like Eastern Europe and in Southeast Asia, because, as Mike was saying earlier, the pivot to Asia, as Obama has been calling it, is not simply a reorganization and redistribution of military resources. It's a redistribution and reorganization of the entire U.S. foreign policy agenda. And they see in the pivot to Asia a chance to both contain and stifle China's growth, but to do it in such a way that they don't have to engage militarily and they don't have to destabilize the world economy, because, of course, as I think Mike was alluding to, a country like China with its dollar holdings presents a very complex challenge for the U.S. establishment. So soft power can sort of achieve a lot of these goals without the United States' direct involvement. Soft power can include precisely what we're seeing in a place like Syria, because, of course, what the United States and its allies have done in Syria is essentially create a proxy war, a proxy army using proxy forces for the purposes of establishing and effecting regime change. And I think that this would also fall under this larger umbrella of U.S. and Western soft power. And soft power is something that is not lost on leadership in Moscow and in Beijing. They understand this perfectly well, and this is part of the reason why they're cracking down so hard on journalists, but they're also cracking down on anything that could be seen as going against the mainstream narrative, because control and monopoly of information and the way in which information is disseminated, in other words, control of the narrative, is absolutely essential in order to maintain and to further their hegemony and to further this agenda.
So control over Syria with a regime that was favorable to U.S. interests and the flow of gas that the U.S. could control in terms of selling in dollars seems to be one of the motivating factors here. And the Saudis are helping reinforce that position by, one, going along and agreeing that that ISIS can be attacked and that they're in support of that, and that, in fact, there's almost an unlimited military capabilities that the U.S. could engage there in Syria. And with our new ISIS enemy there as well, getting rid of both and really controlling that. And the Saudis are going to undermine Russia's capabilities of maintaining their economic status by oversupplying oil to the world, and they're having a negative impact on Russia. So that all fits together. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I mean, if we want a concrete example to take it, you know, sort of make it a real world, live-in issue. In 2011, on the eve of the so-called uprising, the so-called revolution in Syria, there was a deal that was initially struck between Iran, Iraq, then under the government of Prime Minister Maliki, and Syria under Assad, that they would be building a massive gas pipeline that would bring Iranian and Iraqi exports through Syria to the Mediterranean and thereby into the European market. This created a very serious situation and really jeopardized Qatar's place in the gas export market to Europe, and it certainly jeopardized Saudi Arabia's plans. And so you can see that not only do these things fit together in terms of a geopolitical agenda, but certainly an economic agenda as well. The hegemony and dominance of OPEC and the Gulf monarchies in gas exports is not to be challenged by the Iranians and by others who are more closely aligned with them. And, it's no coincidence that within a matter of months after that deal was initially put on the table, you have the Iranian interruption of a war in Syria, really a destabilization of that country. And of course, since then, we've seen a coup, essentially a coup effected by the United States against Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq, whose government is now gone, replaced by a much more compliant puppet government in that country. So you see that it all does fit together in that way, and the pipelines are really, and the energy is really kind of one of the main keys to understanding all of that.
That's the voice of Eric Dratzer of StopImperialism.org. And Mike Whitney, we want to go back to you very quickly for the last 2 minutes. We only have like a minute or two left. We wanted to give you the last word here today, and to sort of dovetail off of what Eric Dratzer was just saying, how would you like to conclude?
Well, I'm so glad that he brought that up, and I can't imagine a more articulate description of what's going on. But what I would like to underline is basically what he said in less words, and just say, this is not two wars going on. You're talking about dueling pipelines. You're talking about, for the United States wants to flip the leadership in Syria so that it can control the pipelines that are going to serve the EU market, the European market, okay? That's who's going to replace the Russian gas. So, in other words, don't be thinking that, you know, we're talking about fighting for sovereignty in Ukraine and we're fighting against ISIS down there. No, we have one global resource war, and behind it all is maintaining the dominance of the dollar. That's what's happening, okay, geopolitically. And so I think if there was anything I'd want people to walk away from this interview thinking about, is just to consider what's going on beyond the propaganda.
That's the voice of Mike Whitney. He is a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion from AK Press. He's also an independent journalist and frequently writes for Counterpunch. You can find his work at counterpunch.org, among other places online. Mike Whitney, thank you so much for taking time out and joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Eric Dratzer, StopImperialism.org, thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to having you on the program again in the future.
Thanks so much. Look forward to it.
Acknowledge the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement at UC Berkeley, and the speech that Mario Savio gave, the very one that's very famous today. Because of the topic today, our show is on imperialism and dollar hegemony, and I think this speech is very appropriate. This is Mario Savio 50 years ago.
Sometimes the grievances of people extend more than just the law, extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, Would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
That was Mario Savio at the University of California, Berkeley, 50 years ago.
Mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to Anthony Fest and Erica Bridgman at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on 20 stations around the U.S. We welcome our new internet affiliate station, World News Radio Today. Archives of the program can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We will see you next time.
Ritualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love.